Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is April 23rd. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz. Delighted you could join me this evening. I'm talking to you this evening from my wonderful bank. I'm one of those people in America who has the best bank in the world, and I love it, National Bank of Malvern in Malvern, Pennsylvania. And it's so amazing that I would be here when I wanted to talk to you about debt, because I've been here for a week and sitting right in the middle of a financial institution that does debt lending the way I love to see it done. When you have a banking institution that facilitates debt lending throughout a community, it can be an extraordinary and very beautiful thing to watch, because you're talking about a financial institution which is increasing and improving financial liquidity in a way that helps people succeed. And the profitability of the institution is very much aligned with the customers, who are small business people or individuals or farmers. And essentially, the financial institution's success depends on helping the people be successful. And where it works and the alignment happens, it's a very beautiful thing. If you've ever seen the Jimmy Stewart movie about It's a Wonderful Life, you know, that's an example of a debt model where it really works. And it was very wonderful for me to be sitting in the middle of one that's working and adding tremendous value to its community and financial ecosystem while I was planning to talk to you about debt. Because so much of what's happened on planet Earth is that we're using debt as an entrapment mechanism and sort of a tool of economic warfare. And instead of facilitating financial liquidity to increase equity, we're basically increasing financial liquidity to harvest equity. So it's a harvesting thing that shrinks total equity. It centralizes and consolidates. And so now it's interesting. The entrapment model of debt is as old as the centuries. It's nothing new. If you go back and watch movies like Barry Lyndon, Stanley Kubrick's movie, or Rob Roy, you see these methods used many centuries ago. What's interesting in the last 50 years is we've integrated, we've basically changed the laws so that predatory lending and all sorts of what has traditionally been considered wildly unethical and awful, unlawful tactics are considered to be sort of standard form business. And if I'd wanted to, I could have called our theme tonight Planet Entrapment, because we've really taken the entrapment model on a scale, starting, of course, with sovereign nations around the world and using it as a really a tool of governance. So think of debt now as a way of managing a highly centralized empire. I'm going to talk tonight in several parts. We're going to talk about planet debt and the history of the debt model, and then go through the 12 things that I think you need to know about the debt model and where this is going. And then I want to cover news and stories in the first quarter, and of course the financial market roundup, and then we'll take a few minutes and look forward. Another thing before we begin that's very important to understand about debt is, as I said, it can be in a healthy model or it can be in a liquidation model. So it really comes down to whether the financial institutions and system is trying to help various parties build equity or whether they're simply trying to harvest their equity. But then there's something else. And oftentimes when you hear commentators talk about debt, they talk about all debt as if it was part of a financial system. And really what we're looking at is much more a governance system than a financial system, particularly when you get in the entrapment side. And it's very important to divide debt into two different kinds of models. So if we could think of, you know, sort of two rows and two columns, one way of slicing the cake is between the building equity and then liquidating equity models. But the other is, and it's related, is you have many people who are issuing debt in a currency that they can print. And if I'm issuing debt in a currency that I can print, really I'm just issuing a future call on my currency. And since I can literally print it off of a computer, it's no sweat off my back. I'm always amazed when people ask me if the U.S. is bankrupt. I put up a quote at the top of the report from Alan Greenspan, who I'm sure you realize I rarely quote, that says the United States can pay any debt it has because we can always print money to do that, so there is zero probability of default. So when you look at a lot of debt, you're looking at debt that can literally be satisfied by the issuer by simply printing more currency. So where you're looking at a sovereign nation issuing debt in a currency that it controls, it's a very, very different picture than if you're borrowing in a currency that you can print and you've got to pay back. So you really want to look at when you look at debt, you want to say, is this the building equity model or is this the harvesting equity model? And is the issuer someone who can print the currency to satisfy it, or is it somebody who's really got to go out into the marketplace and earn it? Very, very different. Okay, in the first section, and I would point out, we have an excellent web presentation. The Solaria team has worked very hard to produce this, so I hope you will access this as you're listening. We're going to start with the first part, introducing the theme, Planet Debt. I wanted to just talk through the history of how empires rule without having to have standing armies all around the world. And I start off with the Holy Roman Empire and describe how essentially at some point the Roman Empire decided leaving standing armies in place wasn't working. And instead they left a church in place that was very much a financial operation. I always say 2,000 years of tax-free returns and diplomatic immunity, supported by a billion members who confess weekly, i.e. the ultimate control file system, and who pay a 10% tithe, is the most economic financial model an empire has ever found. It was followed up, the Holy Roman Empire model was followed up by the British Empire, the Brits and the Europeans, obviously inventing the central bank warfare model, and also the British taking it to a whole global level by controlling the sea lanes. But one thing that happened to the Brits is they came up against the Chinese, and there are historians who believe both the Roman Empire and the British Empire went broke trading with the Chinese. The British fought their way back in with opium, and ever since then, in addition to the sea lanes, narcotics trafficking and sort of the leverage buyout of places has been part of the economic model of running an empire. So that brings us to the Anglo-American alliance, because at the end of the World War II, the Brits really didn't have the natural resources and population or the capacity to field a military for a global empire. And so we see the Anglo-American alliance take place. And it was very much dependent on the central banking warfare model. But the Americans literally took the model to a whole new level by creating a hidden system of finance with gold and other assets. And they also opened their markets. We opened our markets to global narcotics trafficking and built just a juggernaut with the federal credit mechanism, the likes of which the world has ever seen. We also instituted a network of pension and global retirement plans that channeled significant savings into central control. And then finally, the coup de grace was we cut the gold standard in 71. And with that, we created a model that was literally could use debt. It could issue dollar-denominated debt in infinite amount as long as the military was there to police and manage the Bretton Woods system. And we all know the stories of the economic hitmen and the process by which we moved in country after country, trading cheap paper for very dear natural resources and encouraging everyone locally to take out lots of debt so that they could finance our building, construction, engineering, and other products. And the reality is that model was very instrumental in helping increase leverage or debt around the world. And so what you really see emerging is a governance system where debt is simply a mechanism to govern very centrally. And instead of using standing armies, you're using debt and legal contracts. But something has happened in the 80s, starting in the 80s and 90s, and is really coming to fruition now, which changes the whole planet dead picture. And that is what I call the data beast, something I've written and talked about a lot, but certainly became easier for most people to understand with the Snowden revelations and other NSA whistleblowers like William Binney and Thomas Drake. And essentially what's happened is that technological developments have now made it possible to take the economic hit game and that's been played on nations and move it down on an individual basis. So you're not just doing it against nation states or places, you're doing it on an individual basis, one person, one family, because relational database technology, artificial intelligence will allow you to work and harvest people in a variety of different ways. I'll give an example when we get to the 12 things. And so you literally now have built a system far more powerful than the Holy Roman Church system. It's the ultimate control file system. It's the ultimate mechanism for economic harvest. And it's something that we're all grappling with in our lives. And it's a very important aspect of looking at and understanding debt. We moved into the period of the bailouts. So from in the beginning of the 90s, we begin to rebalance the global economy. As we do that, we take the debt up in the developed world, the G7 world, tremendously. There's an explosion of fraudulent debt issued. We hit the bailouts. And what happens is essentially much of that debt gets moved from the financial institutions that engineered the financial coup d'etat into the sovereign governments. So the taxpayers eat the bill, or the central banks eat the bill. But what happens during that is, I'll talk about it when we get to the 12 things you need to know, is debt continues to explode. And I think one of the reasons debt is very much on many people's minds is we keep watching the debt grow and grow, rather than the financial coup and the bailouts changing it. All it did was it shifted it, but the growth continued. And that's part of the reason you're seeing a tremendous blowback around the world. Russia is clearly carrying the load, but you're seeing the BRIC nation saying, you know, wait a minute, we're sick of the entrapment model. We're tired of being harvested. What we all need is to make the pie bigger. If we keep behaving this way, you guys are shrinking the pie. We need to make the pie bigger. And so you're seeing tremendous blowback all around the world. And part of it was as more and more people started to appreciate and their population started to appreciate the danger of this combination of debt with the digital databases. And so as you see that pushback, what you're seeing is people creating independent information systems, internet systems, independent settlement systems, and then independent vehicles to create financial liquidity, whether it's currency swaps or infrastructure investment banks outside the United States. As you all know, I believe that part of this is that if you look at the speed at which the U.S. was moving to build the global governance and global currency system, I don't think they were going fast enough. And I think they were being a little bit too simplistic about how they were doing it. It was too reliant on force. And so what you're seeing is Mr. Global encouraging the BRICS to build out a plan B. And the competition of the two will be the Hegelian dialectic that helps get things there faster. I should note that after everyone paid their taxes on April 15th, the Americans pushed back with a pledge to try and fast-track the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the U.S. trying to bring a lot of people back into the U.S. fold. Now, one of the things I never expected to realize as I was working on this project was to take a hard look at what was happening in education and in healthcare in this country and see where it was really going. Off and on, I've looked at Obamacare, and I've started to look at Common Core and what's happening in education. But it was finally in the process of looking at the way debt was being used to entrap people in places and literally get a majority of the population dependent on either government subsidies or dependent on financial lenders in a variety of ways, that I really saw where I think this is all going. Essentially, you're talking about a process where federally mandated reforms are going to make it possible for private corporations to assume a much larger portion of ownership and control of the entire educational system. And what that's going to mean is that we're literally going to see large corporations having, and intelligence agencies having, direct access to children without the intervention of doctors and teachers and parents, in a way that is really frightening and also is going to be very harmful, I believe, to the, to not just the welfare of the children, but also to their educational success. And so we're talking about literally, and we're also talking about taking two of the most important parts of the economy in any county level in America and flipping them out of something that produces a lot of income and activity for individuals into something that is basically controlled by corporations who can engineer all the labor out. So this is going to be very devastating to local economies, I think far more devastating than many begin to understand. So it's a topic that we'll get into more in the Solari report, but I think one of the reasons we've seen enormous financial entrapment happening in America is there's no way you can get Americans to go along with this unless you've got them over a barrel in a number of ways, and financial is clearly one of them. And I don't think it's an accident. I think there's a tremendous one of the strategic goals of getting them financially entrapped is, in fact, asserting this kind of privatization of education and healthcare, which is clearly not in the best interest of families and children. And it's also mandating market for monopolists. It's clear that the people who are looking to do corporate privatization clearly don't believe in market economies, because they're talking about things where taxpayers are mandated to pay, but they have no input into what's being done and how it's being done. So in both of these instances, whether it's moving to re-engineer and control in a very Soviet kind of model at the local level, or trying to do the same kind of bullying globally, you're seeing the U.S. leadership move to entrap its local populations and global populations at the same time. And it will be very interesting to see if that pushback connects, because right now I think the U.S. leadership is deeply overextended, and it's not surprising that they've moved to try and cover their flank or sort of close doors in the flank in a couple of ways by doing the deal in Iran and Cuba and some others and trying to get the Ukraine off the front page, because this is a leadership that's in real trouble. And one of the reasons they're in real trouble is you're starting to see tremendous consciousness about what they're up to and how deeply disturbing it is. So take a look at the first part, the introduction of the theme Planet Debt. Let's move to 12 things you need to know about global debt, because I think it's it's very important to me to bring this down to sort of the 411, because I know you're all busy people and have many things to do. And ultimately, I want you to understand what's going on in global debt as a way of really having a good map that can help you navigate. So let's get down to the 12 things you need to know. So turn to the section called 12 Things You Need to Know About Global Debt. Let's start. Number one, global debt's nearly doubled since 2007 and 2014. This was not what I expected coming out of the financial coup. I thought, okay, we'll manage the debt. It won't keep exploding. What's interesting about this continued explosion of global debt is that coming into the bailout period, the developed world was highly leveraged, but the developing world was not. What has happened during this period is the developing world has taken on a significant amount of debt, China being one of them. There was one study, one of the McKinsey studies I posted on the website, estimated that 35% of global growth since 2007 came from China's leveraging up. And a lot of that was done with dollar-denominated debt. We now have over 39 countries with a total debt to GDP ratio above 100%. 90% is sort of supposed to be the place that you stagnate. And when you look at those numbers, it's very important to understand that for the countries that are issuing in debt in a currency that they can just print, it's a very different story than the ones who are not. Also, we have some countries that are running big, that are big financial centers like Singapore, the Netherlands, that look like they have more debt than when you sort of look at what they facilitated. It's really a different picture. And finally, we have some countries that have enormous sovereign wealth funds. And so if you look at their debt on a net basis, they're much stronger than they look. But nevertheless, it's a picture of tremendous debt that keeps on growing. And of course, the question that we all keep asking is, what's the end game? And I think it's very important to understand that a lot of what you see here is not so much a financial system, it's a governance system. Debt is the way that we're affecting central control. And that brings us to the sort of the second question, which is, well, who owns the debt? And this is where the debt picture gets very frustrating. Point number two is the accessible statistics on debt are very insufficient to see our situation clearly. First of all, the available information on global debt is spotty. The statistics on who issues, that is, who borrows, is pretty good, particularly for global sovereign debt. Although I would point out, in the case of U.S. sovereign debt, I absolutely believe that the numbers are not reliable, and I have a lot of anecdotal experience and stories to say that they aren't, including that the federal government has refused to produce audited financial statements for decades, as is required by law. So they have violated the law by not producing financial statements. And if somebody refuses to comply with the law about their financial statements, there's likely to be serious problems with them. But there is good statistics on government borrowers, at least their overt borrowing, and less statistics on financial institutions, small business households, where there is highly insufficient data is on who really owns the debt. And this is tricky because a lot of times if you look at who owns it, they in fact can be sort of what's called cut out or front organizations, and the guy who really controls it is behind the scenes. So putting together a picture of who owns the debt can get very murky. Clearly, where debt is owned by pension funds, mutual funds, foreign governments, there's a lot of good statistics there. But the reality is that a clear, coherent picture of who controls the debt is as hidden behind the one-way mirror as the one-way mirror of the digital data beast. And I suspect they converge, and that's for a reason, but the picture has yet to be illuminated. Number three, global debt is an essential component of the central banking warfare model. So as I said, put aside the healthy lenders, a lot of what we're watching with the growth of global debt is not an alignment where you're trying to help parties build more equity, but it's a control system and a governance system. And that control system very much depends on the military, which is why there is a relationship between the global military expenditures spent by the people with fiat currencies in the central banking warfare model and the debt that gets issued. So it's a circular picture. You issue debt to finance the military that makes it possible to force people or get people to take your currency and your debt denominated in your fiat currency, and around you go. Number four, understanding the economy requires financial statements which integrate the covert cash flows. One of the reasons I get so frustrated when people say, oh, we're bankrupt. Well, if you issue debt and then spend money on secret projects, and the secret projects aren't on the balance sheet, and the, whether it's the underground facilities or the spaceships or the, the black budget weaponry. So if all the assets are not on the balance sheet, but the debt is, well, then of course you're going to look bankrupt. But we need to have a conceptual framework in our minds for a balance sheet that incorporates the debt that they issue off balance sheet and the assets that disappear and the money that disappears. So, again, it's frustrating because we don't have, we don't have financial statements for the covert side, but we're going to have to imagine them into the balance sheet and into the income statements because they're very, very real. And it's one of the reasons why people looking at the official statements were saying, oh, the economy is going to collapse. And I'm trying to intuit the covert flows and saying, no, it's going to slow burn. And that's one of the reasons why. Number five, invasive digital systems have fundamentally altered the nature and economics of debt. As I said, digital systems have converted the financial system to something that can be used to entrap and harvest at an individual level. It's not just hits on countries, it's hits on people. And let me give you an example, because it's one I saw when I moved to the South. It's one I saw implemented in a very, I live in a county of very modest means, and I watched it played on people who had very little money and saw the dramatic impact that it had on their lives. Okay, so let's take a nice middle-class family, and the father has a nice job in a manufacturing company, he's doing very well, so he decides to buy a new home. He and his wife originate a mortgage for their family of four. They from a local bank, from a local financial institution. The bank sells the mortgage to Fannie Mae after collecting the origination fee. Again, the institution is not liable on the mortgage once it's been securitized. The father works at a local manufacturer, and the financial institution happens to know that they're moving to Mexico, but the father doesn't. They don't tell the father that he's about to lose his job, which is, of course, a material omission. 24 hours after he loses his job, miraculously, his credit card company just happens to raise the interest rates to 30%, not surprisingly. One of his kids gets sick a couple weeks later. The family's lost its medical coverage, so the father has to use the credit card to pay for the expenses. So now he's paying 30% interest rate on the medical expenses, and as you can imagine, falls behind on his mortgage payment. At that point, the family's only income is unemployment compensation and food stamps, which is clearly insufficient to cover the family's overhead despite very significant reductions in their spending. Mysteriously, a local marijuana dealer just happens to know that now's a propitious time to make a visit. Just think of it as a marketing call. The father, being under extreme stress, begins to smoke again in order to handle the stress. One night while he's getting high, an associate of the drug dealer steals his car, and the insurance covers the cost, but the insurance premiums go up, and of course he can't, his credit score has essentially been destroyed, so he doesn't qualify for an auto loan, which means he has to buy a used car, which is financed at a predatory rate. Again, more origination fees and all sorts of fees involved. The family is now desperate, and they sell their home to pay to liquidate the remaining equity to cover living expenses and the high interest rates they're paying on the auto loan and on their higher mortgage premiums, and then of course the 30% interest on the medical expenses. The financial institution originates another loan and again sells it to Fannie Mae. The auto loan and the Fannie Mae pools are securitized and sold to a fund that's held in the father's IRA, that is, before he liquidates it to help pay for his mortgage and auto loan. When Fannie Mae goes bust in 2008, the taxpayers, including this family, are called upon to finance the bailout. Interestingly enough, when a banker at the financial institution realizes that client data and is being compromised and they're engaging in predatory practices, she tries to blow the whistle and, in fact, is murdered on one morning when she's out jogging and is found on the jogging path dead. So in a relatively short period, the family goes from being a successful middle-class family with savings to a family that's been profitably harvested by the financial system. And what the father and the family and those around him cannot fathom is that the financial institution, the credit card company, the marijuana dealer, the car thief, the car dealer, and the insurance company were all drawing from essentially one relational database operation designed to profitably harvest people and locations. The one person who could fathom it is the banker who tried to be a whistleblower and ended up dead. And that is what is happening, and it's happening via our televisions, our computers, our smartphones, our smart meters. American households are providing access to personal and intimate financial data, and that is going to syndicates of intelligence agencies and large corporations who are using that data to do a variety of things, but one is to harvest people in very predatory ways. And so, as I said, the one-way mirror allows the economic hitman to be done on an economic basis against poor people. And so we've engineered and created a structure where creditors can make money engineering failure. And as I said, when creditors work hard to help people succeed, it's a very different model than when it's an entrapment machine and they profit from failure. Okay, number six, consolidating the global economy necessitated that the war on terror target financial institutions in Islam. A very important thrust of the war on terror has been to get the Islamic world to make its financial flows transparent to the Western financial institutions and intelligence agency. It's part of the whole effort to build a global digital infrastructure that will allow the U.S. to enforce against global financial institutions on the pretext that they're involved with American deposits or investments one way or the other. But also it's important to understand that the Islamic principles reject interest and certainly usurious levels of interest. And if you look at the financial model, the debt model that was being used really is an entrapment model. It was not going to fly in Islam. And so a great effort has been made on the pretext of the war of terror to get Islam to be brought into the West's central banking warfare model. And that is a very important part of what has happened. The seventh thing you need to know is that the digital systems combined with revisions of law related to usury, bankruptcy, student loans, as well as the foreign financial institutions, that has all made it possible to assert the kind of control that you need is in terms of legal and financial mechanisms to maintain what's called enormous divergence in the cost of capital between insiders and outsiders or between preferred players and the average person. This is very much at the heart of the slow burn, and I talk about it a lot. But, for example, in the 1990s, while someone like our father, who I just described an example, is paying 30% on his interest rates on his credit card, we had hedge funds borrowing on the yen carry trade for 0%. So for preferred players who were playing along with the inside game could get capital for 0%, whereas certain people in America are paying 30%. That's an enormous divergence, and it went on for many, many years. Certainly, Senator Elizabeth Warren has talked about how the big banks can borrow at the Fed window for essentially 0%, whereas students on federal education loans are paying a tremendous amount, and that divergence has been going on for many, many years. I know in the end of the last housing bubble in 1989, 1990, 1991. You watch tremendous federal credit arbitrage where banks were borrowing, essentially for zero and turning around and putting it into the long treasury market for, at that point, it was a 500, 600 basis point spread, making enormous profits. And that's how they rebuilt their equity. Some of that happened. The spread was not as extreme. But that's part of what happened during the bailouts was the access to capital was made possible at very low cost, while many people in America were paying a much higher cost. And of course, as taxpayers, they were having to backstop and fund the bailouts in the first place. These kinds of divergences in cost of capital basically rig society so that some win and some lose, not because they're efficient in the marketplace, but because they have a rigged deal. And this is part of what's been destroying the health of the economy, because ultimately rigged players make things less productive and they make things stupid. The eighth thing you need to know is that the national security state's integration of the invasive digital systems has expanded the use of debt as a weapon of economic warfare and financial coup d'etat. And if you look at the explosion of global debt, it doesn't seem to be letting up whatsoever. The important thing to understand is when you look at debt with these systems, you need to see it as part of a package. So economic warfare, if you lend to someone and then you proceed to act against them with cyber warfare and financial sanctions. Perfect example was the farmers in the 80s. If you study the militia movement, you discover what happened in the late 70s. An effort was made to dramatically increase the lending to farmers. Farmers were encouraged to take out, these American farmers were encouraged to take out enormous loans. And after they did, suddenly the farm subsidies were cut and the Fed dramatically increased interest rates. And so the cost of their debt skyrocketed at the same time the subsidies they depended on to pay the debt were cut. And so it was a move of economic warfare. Many farmers went bust. The FBI and the IRS moved against them as well. And so many of them were forced to or lost their land, and large players consolidated and picked up a huge amount of land. And as they were moved off the land, they realized that they had been targeted by economic warfare. Hence, they organized into the militia groups. And a great deal was made by the press as to how sort of radical or horrible these people weren't. They weren't radical or horrible at all. If you see what had been done to them, that was pretty radical and pretty horrible. But what you're seeing is a very systemic use of these kinds of techniques of economic warfare, and debt is simply a piece of it, which is why when you participate as a business or an individual in borrowing or taking out debt, you really need to see the full portfolio of the people you're dealing with, and how is it a straight up financial deal, or are you by entering into a debt with that institution making yourself out to be a target of economic warfare? Okay, the ninth thing you need to know is that the growth of debt, as I said before, as an entrapment system since World War II has inspired significant and growing blowback. And I think there is a real plan B underway. I think Mr. Global is certainly permitting that plan B. And now the Americans are facing a much more informed global audience and growing economic competition. Okay. The 10th thing you need to know, global debt, who controls? We don't know who controls the debt. And one of the hardest things I have in predicting the American position is, to what extent do the Americans control a lot of that debt quietly behind the scenes or not? Who really controls that debt? Another question, a little more certainly far out, is it an open or closed system? In other words, do members of the human race and their institutions own and control all that debt? So are we just borrowing money from each other? Are other civilizations involved? I have to ask that question because I don't know. But the fact that it's uncertain means that we don't know if it's an open or closed system. And who really controls? I think, as I said before, if you could follow those dollars and contracts back, ultimately we could see who Mr. Global really was and what the current governance arrangements really are. But who owns and controls that debt has very, very powerful implications for the evolution of civilization. You know, and if the genie came out of the bottle, that's a question, that's certainly a question that I would want answered. The 11th thing you need to know is I call this Houston, we have a problem. The problem with the debt system and the exploding debt system is the puppet master who controls the strings is clearly trying to assert much tighter and greater control over society. And the part of this that scares me to death is when you look at what they're up to with healthcare and education in this country. I think you're talking about wiping out the last vestiges of local economies and doing it in a way that give corporations and intelligence agencies direct access to children in a way which I can only describe as terrifying. It's almost as though somebody said, look, let's think of kids as simply oil and gas deposits to be harvested. And we're going to organize things to get to simply exploit them as an economic resource. It's pretty terrifying. So I think one of the things we need to think about is how can we reverse engineer the entrapment, because this is going no place good. The last thing you need to know about global debt is we need to be thinking about the end game, because we don't know what the end game is, but it's going to be part of an ongoing conversation on the Solari report, because we're going to have to see how things unfold. But I think it's important to you and me how it unfolds. And so, again, ongoing conversation. Let me describe a couple of my expectations of the general direction where planet debt is taking us. One is, the goal is to re-engineer global governance, and this is all part of an expanding financial coup d'etat. The financial coup d'etat did not end with the bailouts. It's kept on going. So I expect to see further centralization of currencies and the implementation of digital currencies. One subscriber put in a question for Ask Catherine asking about the latest push by JP Morgan Chase to outlaw cash in its safe deposit box and discourage cash. It all fits in. This is how we're pushing for the implementation of digital currencies. And of course, digital currencies mean money that can be tracked 24/7 by systems and artificial intelligence. Again, all part of the digital data beast. The second thing I expect is increased what I call piratization. Piratization is privatization that does not reflect market values. It reflects windfall subsidies and profits for private investors and corporations. I think high debt loads are going to be used to force countries and municipalities to privatize valuable assets. High debt loads are going to force many citizens to go along, or dependence on subsidies financed with debt. And I think this is going to continue to help grow the number of large corporations and their earnings and assets, and get more companies into the securitized space, where, again, centralized control is easier to effect. I think there's going to be continued pressure on retirement benefits and pension obligations in the developed world. And part of that's going to happen by simply making pension funds buy a lot of debt, which is then debased, and that effectively drains their yields. But there's going to be pressure to direct pension fund assets to serve centralized interests. One of the things that concerns me about the federal mandates to re-engineer education in this country is I think part of it is to engineer labor out of it so you can use online systems and other systems to make it very economic for corporations to control and have direct access to children without teachers interfering. But then one of the biggest pools of capital in this country are teacher pension funds. And I think the more you get the teachers in a corner, the easier it is to impact what happens with those pension funds. I think there's going to be increased global activity on large infrastructure projects. Certainly, if you have this kind of infinite debt capacity, there's no doubt one of the things that there's tremendous demand for infrastructure globally if you rebalance the global economy, and that's going to happen one way or another. I think another thing is there's going to be pressure to keep up military expenditures as the developed world tries or sort of chokes on their military expenditures levels and probably diminishes them. There's going to be pressure on the developing world to pick up the tab and increase military expenditures. And certainly if the Bretton Woods system continues to unravel, which it looks like it is, then you're going to have more countries around the world feeling the necessity of having those military expenditures to basically defend their position and get other people to take their currency. I think we're going to have continued high levels of global indebtedness for some time. You need a lot more cooperation to move from a world of this high indebtedness to something that makes a lot more sense. You see the Christine Lagarde at the IMF talking a lot about this and the danger of global stagnation as a result. And I think one of the reasons the BRICS are moving so strongly to come up with alternative systems that will allow a model that promotes the growth of equity is they understand at some point, as one subscriber always says, at some point we have to bake more pies. We can't just sit around stealing each other's pies. I expect continued growth in the size of global equity markets. It's to a certain extent, if you look at the explosion of debt as the bond market turns, which I think it will, the question is, where is all the cash going to go? Where's all the money going to go? And I think the reality is it's going to go into the equity markets. It's going to crash up the value of real assets. Now, that doesn't have to happen. There are scenarios where we go into a deflation and war and things very much go down in a sort of the Great Depression scenario. But I believe the crash up is much more likely, particularly if you look at all the plans to bring companies and assets into the securitized markets and to build out the infrastructure of the rebalancing of the global economy. So I think a crash up is more likely, but again, the alternative can happen, which is really very much a crash down. And I think there's going to be continued inquiry as to where all the missing assets and money are disappearing to. One of the reasons that everyone or many of us feel drained on planet Earth is we are being drained. It's almost as though we have, think of planet Earth as a giant mortgage REIT and there's a dividend disappearing to someone somewhere. And the reality is if producing that dividend is something that continually destroys equity, at some point we're really going to collapse, whether environmentally or economically. So I think there's going to be more and more inquiry as to, listen, where is all this missing money going? And why do we have to do it this way? Because unfortunately, the secrecy and the controls between top-down mandates, centralized control, and missing money, we're talking about a phenomenally unproductive economic system and one that, literally, if you could turn this around to a system that optimized building wealth, you could have hundreds of the financial wealth that we have now. There's no economic reason for poverty on this planet. But at the same time, we can't get to a system that lives in harmony with the ecology and allows us to optimize in markets with each other without having some manner of truth and clarity about the governance system and where we're really putting our governmental or governmentally induced assets. What is absolutely essential for you to know from looking at the planet debt situation is it's extremely important that when you personally or your business engages in any debt transaction, you need to understand what are the financial institutions who are aligned and make money from your success and which are the ones that are not aligned and make money from your failure. And it's extremely important to, as much as possible, to only connect and allow institutions or people in your life that are aligned and to avoid the others. It's one of the reasons that you'll hear Franklin Sanders often say that all government money comes with a sock in the jaw. And that's it. You're taking money from somebody with whom you're not aligned. But I appreciate sometimes you have to. So it's a very individual and unique situation. Okay, that's it for the 12 things you need to know. Again, please check out the web presentation. I think there's some wonderful graphs and charts and information for you, and our team has worked very hard to get them, and I hope you enjoy them. Okay, let's turn to the section on news stories and trends. If you looked at our annual wrap-up, you saw the trends that we presented. Our theme for the annual wrap-up was Planet Equity. As we had Planet Debt for the first quarter, we had Planet Equity. And then we had 12 themes, and they track. I told you that those would be the trends that would be important in 2015, and sure enough, they very much dominated the first quarter. So let's just quickly run through. If you look at the web presentation, you can see links to some of the top stories I chose. Planet Equity, the global stock markets continued to grow. And over the last 3 years, the U.S. markets moved smartly ahead. And what we saw was the European and Asian stock markets begin to close that gap. So the divergence narrowed with certainly in the first 3 months, plus the following 2 to 3 weeks. Germany and China moving up strongly. The story I chose was China Blossoms, which is a commentary I wrote about the Chinese equity markets and what they were doing. Lots of criticism of China and the Chinese economy in the American press, some of which is appropriate. China has very much depended on increased leverage and has far to go in building their own local sort of domestic consumer markets. But I think if you look at China's growth and if you look at China's many strengths, I for one have a much better picture of the long term and short term in China. And you can see some of the reasons why in China Blossoms. The oil card, the east-west pendulum, the rebalancing the global economy continued. And to me, the big story in the first quarter was the blowback against the U.S., and I posted a series of the different stories involved with that, as well as the impact of much lower oil and gas prices, including on the independent oil and gas producers here in the United States. So, but we certainly felt the oil card at play, and we certainly felt the blowback. And part of that blowback came in the form of the slowdown in the global economy. Our next trend, Global 3.0 rises. You can see that everywhere. The stories I chose for the first quarter was the CERN Hadron Collider restarts, and we're still trying to figure out the mystery what the collider is really about. The other story I chose was Etsy going public with an almost $2 billion valuation. Some of these new hot internet stocks, you look at the valuations and you just shake your head. Etsy is a particular favorite of mine. I love the Etsy site, but $2 billion blew my mind. Global 2.0 struggles. What I pointed out was that the G7 and Bilderberger meetings are in Europe in June and the Bohemian Grove is in July, and we see U.S. leadership falling all over itself to try and impress the oligarchs at those meetings. And it's pretty sickening, particularly because what you're seeing emerge in the United States in terms of the presidential campaign, you have a competition between different factions to run the same system, same old, same old. They're just simply competing for who's going to get the pork. And at this point, they're simply trying to perform for a beauty contest of Bilderbergers and Bohemian Grovers, and they couldn't care less what people think. And the hubris is pretty sickening and scaring, because what's probably going to happen is two candidates emerge, both of whom are lawyers. I love lawyers, but we don't, you know, we need engineers and builders. We don't need more lawyers telling the world what to do. And unfortunately, if you look at the sort of campaigns that are emerging, it's people who know how to bully the planet. They don't know how to cooperate and build. They know how to mandate. They know how to rig things. They really don't know how, you know, to grow an economy bottom up. And it's a little bit scary to think that we would waste another 2 years on a campaign and then 4 years or 8 years on administrations of people who really belong to the old world and not the world we're going into. And the last thing America can afford is poor leadership. But unfortunately, it looks like that's what's cooking up. And so the stories I chose was my commentary, the hubris bubble, and then another story on the dead bankers, which shows you there's seems to be all over the financial system. People struggling to do the right thing and, of course, getting punished for it. The next trend, the uncivil society. My comment was, who says the American people don't get it? It looks to me like they do. And I posted the link to the survey we've talked about several times on the fact that institutional credibility is hitting an all-time low. It just shows you that people really do understand. The education tsunami, I've gotten quite an education on where federal mandates and educational policy could take education in this country. It's absolutely frightening. And I posted my book review of The Educator and the Oligarch, a wonderful book by Anthony Cody, who is going to be on the Solari Report this coming in May. And I really hope you listen to that. Also, an article about students walking out on Common Core testing. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Students revolt. And also a story about the targeting of Atlanta teachers, which shows you how serious they're planning on being. Teachers being sent to prison for years on the theory that they were cheating on the tests. It's a long, complicated story, but the Chinese have a saying, to scare the monkeys, all you need to do is kill a chicken. And I think the precedent of the extent to which teachers are being targeted is very, very dangerous as part of this. Emerging the global currency is our next trend. And of course, the Russians, the Chinese. Putin was at it with stories I posted were Putin's call for Eurasia currency union, and then the Russian banks transacting MasterCard operations through the national payment system. Again, I think all of this is Mr. Global and the Hegelian dialectic building out a plan B. Next trend, the 21st century move into space. And I pointed out two things. One is the secret space program videos are now available to the public and have gotten extraordinary. I've been amazed for long and serious videos. They've gotten a lot of views and have really started a conversation in many places. And if you haven't had a chance to access them, I would encourage you to do so. The other thing is that Japan is beginning a national security space buildup. We hear a lot of announcements out of Japan about space, but I think this is very interesting because if you look at the resources they have in the engineering area, they've got an engineering juggernaut. So if Japan puts itself very seriously towards building out space, it's going to be interesting. Transhumanism, I posted the story of from the Washington Post, Tech Titan's latest project, Defy Death. And I think it's important to take this seriously because, in fact, this is coming from the same group of people in general, the same area of the people who are trying to get direct access to your kids. So it's unnerving that these folks are trying to get direct access to your kids at the same time they're planning on living forever. Makes transhumanism an even more chilling subject. Wicked problems was the next trend, and I said I chose my story. The Inuit, the Eskimos, say that the poles are shifting. And I wrote, from a respected source, but given the implications, this is one we won't worry about. I once asked somebody what would happen in Hickory Valley if the poles shift, and then I realized, oh, you know, I'm not prepared to build an underground base, so I guess I don't have to worry about this one. The demographic derby, I pointed out the story about California public workers may be at risk of losing promised pensions regarding the court decisions as to creditors' rights versus pension fund obligations in municipalities. It's very interesting court precedents, and I expect to see more and more both legal actions and discussion on the pressure between municipal debt and other municipal demands and what it's going to mean to pension funds. Then the next one is food and water grow scarce. And the story is sovereign wealth funds ramp up food and agriculture purchases. We're seeing an amazing amount of news in the business and investment press that sovereign wealth funds are thinking very strategically about what are the resources our country needs and how can we invest proactively globally to diversify and lock up supply. Very strategic thinking. So not surprisingly, food and agriculture is very high on the list. And you're also seeing, it's very interesting, because the growth in the demand for fresh and organic healthy food has just been gangbusters for quite some time now. You're seeing companies saying they literally can't get the supply they need, and so they're going out and investing in land and farms and literally integrating vertically to do so. So don't be surprised if we start to see much more investment in food and agriculture. And then finally, the infrastructure opportunity. As China attempts to build out their currency globally, one of the techniques is to build high-speed trains. And so, of course, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which was the talk of the globe in the first quarter, and Israel applying to join. You know they want the desalination contracts. Anyway, so there it is. I didn't rewrite or add a lot about the detailed description of the trends. There's great descriptions in the annual wrap-up. No need to repeat it here. And if you haven't read the annual wrap-up, you can certainly access the description of trends there. And, you know, it's a great write-up. So please, if you haven't accessed it, I encourage you to do it. Okay, let's take a look at financial markets. We start with an overview of all the equity and commodities markets. And I'm going to go through this chart by chart, but you can take a sweep at the first chart. The U.S. dollar, after rising 12% last year, continued to rise in 2015. As of the last Friday's close, the U.S. dollar index was up another 10%. So a very strong, it was up 9% in the first quarter, and then several weeks later it was up 10%. Of course, it ran up to 100. It's backed off now to about 98. It's been bouncing around between 97 and 98. But again, very strong dollar performance. That's putting real pressure on the U.S. equity markets because about 42% of the S&P is very much influenced by the dollar. Their profits are very much influenced by the dollar. Consolidating foreign earnings or a strong dollar hurting exports. So, and the highest one, the one most impact is the tech sector, which has been one of the strong parts in the market. So a strong dollar is putting pressure downwards on corporate earnings, although low interest rates continue to provide low cost of capital for large corporations. And we see large corporations taking advantage, particularly of a cheap euro. That kind of financing continues to help finance stock purchases. Now, if you look traditionally at a strong dollar, the year after a strong dollar is usually a good stock market year. And of course, we're coming into presidential elections. Both argue for the bull trend to continue. If you look into the S&P, what you see is the poorest performance came from the large caps. We have stronger performance for the first quarter. In the strongest performance was the mid caps, and then the small caps, and then the companies with buyback programs. If you look by sector, real estate was the strongest, followed by healthcare, and then communication services. The biotechs, which have been very, very strong, backed off and corrected in the first quarter and seem to be coming back now. Healthcare, as I said, continued to be strong with I call it the stock profits of Obamacare, continuing to carry the market. Oil, the lower oil and gas profits, prices really help some sectors, particularly airline and transportation. And I put up a snapshot of the strongest motif investing. And what you'll see is, of course, on the road was the motif that was the most successful over the last year. 1 year return of 43.9%. And that's very much as the airlines with the result of lower oil and gas prices. The administration is putting a lot of stress with the housing institutions on easing mortgage lending terms, and of course, interest rates remain low. So the home builder has outperformed the broad market. And as I said, real estate did well, was the best part or the strongest sector for the first quarter. Oil and gas prices remained depressed, down 20% at the end of the first quarter. And that's just, that's for this year on top of the tremendous drop last year. Interestingly enough, Russia came up this year. The Russian ETF is up 16% as of the end of the quarter. The star performer, if you look around the global markets, was the German equities, who were the beneficiary of the ECB announcing a bond buying program. The DAX was up, let's take a look, up 22% at the end of the first quarter, and as of last Friday's close, up 26%, and then was almost surpassed by China. Germany and China seem to be having a competition. So China went up through the 20% and I think backed off and is up a little bit higher now. But anyway, so China's had quite a strong first quarter, and then plus the 3 weeks. And I'll show you some charts there. India had a strong year last year, and it's also up. And then, of course, the emerging markets, with China and India as part of the broad market, were up 2% in the first quarter against a essentially flat S&P. Then the developed markets outside of the North America, so if you just take all developed markets outside of U.S., were up in the first quarter about 5% against a flat S&P. So surprise, surprise, what we see is we expected a strong dollar to really mean continued strength for the U.S. market against foreign markets, but that's not what happened. Europe and Asia catch up, and the emerging markets did remarkably well. The one sector that was down was the frontier markets. Frontier markets were down, depending on which vehicle you use. The one I use is down about 5%. The fixed income markets, we were not expecting to have a good first quarter. The real concern was the Fed would start to raise interest rates, but with a sluggish U.S. economy, the Fed has clearly indicated that they're going to be delayed in raising rates, and so the bonds put in a respectable performance. The long Treasury was up 3.8%. It was much higher. It was up almost 10% for the year in January, and then dropped back to about 3.8%. Has dropped a little bit since then, and the bond aggregate with a shorter duration is up about 1%. But given where we thought bonds might be, a pretty respectable performance. And then gold and silver got off to a strong year, and that has kind of fizzled out. And at this point, if you look at last Friday's close, gold is essentially down 0.5% for the year. So, and it's bounced a little bit since then. But essentially, gold and silver, precious metals, going sideways at this point. And then finally, commodities. If you look at the full commodity basket, very much contributing to that is the oil price. Commodities continue to be down. We started to look like we got a little bit of a bounce in February, but then the trend line went back down. So, commodities still in the basement. And I think coming into summer, summer traditionally is not a good time for the stock market. Coming into summer, as I've said now for 3 years, we're way overdue for a 10 to 25% correction. It's hard to believe that we're not going to get it this summer, but who knows, anything can happen. So my quote for the financial market section was from Hugh Hendry. I'm a great fan of Hugh Hendry at the Eclectic Fund. He says, "I'm a student of uncertainty. I have no idea where the stock market is going to be." And I think that's the way many of us feel. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the first quarter wrap-up. We have a great month coming up. We have Anthony Cody, Well, next week we have Whitley Strieber. The big picture, I gave the annual wrap-up to Whitley and said, okay, what did I forget? What did I miss? And of course, Whitley had some great ideas and great suggestions. So that's a very good conversation. Then we have Lawrence Wilkerson, and I had asked him to talk about national security, but it involved into a real discussion of American leadership and our position in the world and the unraveling of the Bretton Woods situation, and a wonderful strategic overview of the important issues. I can't recommend that to you enough, and that's going to be followed by Anthony Cody, wonderful educator on Common Core and where the educational establishment in this country is going. I'm leaving Pennsylvania this week, and Saturday I'm going up to New York. We have a wonderful luncheon with Richard Dolan at the 21 Club on Saturday, and then I'll turn around, head down to Washington for dinner with friends, and then back to Hickory Valley. And on May 9th, I head to Australia and New Zealand for a month, and hope to be reporting to you on what's going on in Asia from there. And, so this is going to be a very interesting couple of months, and great stuff on the Soleri Report. I had hoped that we would have the new blog up by now, but I posted a wonderful commentary this week called A Word from Our Sponsor, and described a little bit about what's going on at Soleri and what we're thinking about. I hope you take the time to read that. But we hope to have it up in the second quarter, and so I thank you very much for your patience. So next week, there's no money in markets. You'll be hearing the interview with Whitley Strieber, and then I'll be back in the first week of May with money in markets. So until then, ladies and gentlemen, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.